today, the morning after the UK voted to leave the European Union, we ask what the economic implications are for our state. Did you know the UK is the single biggest foreign employer in Illinois? We speak with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and hear additional perspective from the Illinois Farm Bureau's senior economist. Later, the Illinois artist who has made thousands of crosses for victims of violence recently placed 49 in Orlando. It's an issue Greg Zanis has experienced firsthand.
When I put a cross up, sure, it's for the victim, but it's also for myself and for my family and for my personal grieving.
And finally, we know that it's Friday. This weekend, Game of Thrones fans are eager to see how this season 6 ends. The Chicago co-hosts of the Nerdette podcast join us to share their thoughts about how everything will unfold between the Starks and the Lannisters. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been hearing coverage all morning about the stunning vote in the UK last night to leave the European Union. So today, we wanted to start the 21st talking about what this means for our state. And what comes to mind immediately is our economy. As the financial markets are absorbing this news, the British pound is plunging in value. We thought it was important to spend the first part of today's program talking about the economic implications. Illinois is the largest exporter in the Midwest. Goods and services produced here actually rank as the fifth highest exporting state in the country. So what does all of this mean for Illinois? Joining us to talk about this, Phil Levy from Highland Park is a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Phil, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us to provide an agricultural perspective on all of this, and particularly with an eye to Illinois farmers, is a senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau, Mike Doherty. He's on the line from Bloomington. Hey, Mike, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Phil, I wonder if you could start for us by describing how much Illinois' economy is linked to both the UK and the EU.
I think we've got fairly extensive links, and both sort of direct and indirect. Some of the direct links, you've got EU and UK companies as major employers in Illinois. I think you have over 55,000 people employed by UK firms investing. And the UK is the number one investor in Illinois by that measure, but then, you know, not too far behind them are places like Germany. So there's those direct links, and then there's the indirect links, which is they're a big part of the global economy, and if that takes a hit, it's likely to be felt here.
Yeah, and so there's all of that that I'd like to unravel in the next few minutes and kind of pick apart that, not just the global implications, but what it may mean for us directly. And when we, what kind of businesses, Phil, what kind of businesses and companies are we talking about? Before we get to the agricultural ones, I think people may not remember companies, for example, like Aon. Is that who we're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Aon is the number one for an investment sort of firm coming in that way. BP, which used to be sort of British Petroleum. First Group, WPP, there's a range, often, you know, service-related, sort of high-end, but it's a very important relationship. And those are the British firms. If you look at UK firms, looking at a list here, Schneider Electric from France, Siemens from Germany, Continental from Germany. So there's an extensive relationship.
Right. As we think about our global economy, Mike, I wanted to ask you about our agricultural exports. I know corn and soybeans are our biggest ones for our state here in Illinois. Where does most of that go? Not to Europe, right?
Right. You know, we're fortunate in that the two major crops, corn and soybeans, corn is a very small percent of that is exported thanks to our ethanol. So that between that and U.S. cattle, pork, and chickens, they consume most of our corn here. So we're not so dependent on exports for corn. Soybeans, on the other hand, we are very export-dependent in Illinois, and we export over half of our soybean crops. So 60-65% of those soybeans you see growing out there this year, that's going to get exported overseas. But the top buyer for those, far and beyond anyone else, is China. Which will buy, last year bought 1 billion bushels of U.S. soybeans.
And as we think about that, Mike and Phil, both of you, and Phil, I wonder if you could start by weighing in, even if it's not China, as we think about our global ties in the market here, when we're looking at the reaction, we're looking at particularly what's happening with the sterling. I wonder, Phil, if you could talk a little bit about the strong dollar and how that affects exports and companies doing business here in Illinois and exporting that.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, one of the things you often see when people get a whiff of crisis around the world is that they will try to put money into the United States. We saw this in the global financial crisis, and the effect of that can be to bid up the dollar, and that in turn means that U.S. exporters, whether they are in the agricultural sector or Illinois Tool Works or whoever, their goods look relatively more expensive compared to competitors around the world.
Mike, you want to weigh in?
Well, yeah, anything that affects the value of the U.S. dollar will have an immediate effect on the markets, our corn and soybean markets, because that's the number one way in transmission of the relative purchasing, relative prices between corn being or soybeans being sold from Illinois and soybeans being sold from Brazil or from Argentina to the Chinese or to the Filipinos or to the Mexicans. So that any change in the value of the U.S. dollar versus those other currencies has an immediate effect. And in fact, this morning, corn prices were down significantly on the news of Brexit. And I suspect that's probably because of concerns over the boosting that will give to the U.S. dollar strength.
I'm speaking with, that's Mike Doherty. He's a senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's on the line with us from Bloomington, from the Chicago area. Phil Levy is a trade expert. He's a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. As we talk about all of this, if you have any questions for them or comments about this, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your comments as well to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Phil, can I ask you just about, as we are thinking about this, and you were writing about this a couple weeks ago, I was reading what you were writing about Brexit in Foreign Policy magazine. We're really, as everyone who's been listening to the coverage of the past 24 hours, people are very surprised by this. And I want to ask you about sort of the unknown territory that we're in right now and how long we think this is going to have an immediate sort of short-term impact on the financial markets as we're seeing them kind of roiling this morning trying to figure out how to absorb this news.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that there's a huge degree of uncertainty, and it really caught people by surprise. I think if you looked over the last couple of days, you had seen markets think that everything was pretty much under control. They were rising. Apparently, just one of those British betting firms, right as polls were about to
Ladbrokes,
close.
Right. There's always a British betting firm betting
there's
on
always,
something.
Always. They're wonderful that way. But they had something like a 94% chance of remain as the polls were about to close. So this caught everyone by surprise. And one of the things here is you may think, okay, well, now we execute the standard playbook for having a country leave the European Union. The problem is there is no standard playbook for this. It hasn't been done. The UK has been sort of entrenched in Europe for decades, and it's not an easy thing to extricate. And one thing for your listeners that we can keep in mind is this vote was basically, it had no legal standing. It was an advisory to the government saying, go ahead, take us out of Europe. But as of this morning, they're still in Europe, and their goods count as European goods. But what happens next, we really don't know, and it's going to take quite a while to disentangle. The one thing I would also add to the earlier discussion, if it sounds strange to be talking about, what this does in places like China or Asia, no, this is a global shock. I mean, overnight, the Japanese market fell by almost 8%, which is a huge move. But just what we were talking about, this sort of great degree of uncertainty about what comes next, I think that's part of what's driving that.
Well, and as speaking of uncertainty, we're hearing from one Illinois company reacting this morning, that's Caterpillar, as we're thinking about companies, the huge multinational companies based in Illinois that are very dependent on global business for what they do. Caterpillar's based in Peoria. Their UK director, Mark Dorsett, said in a statement, as a global manufacturer with a large footprint in the UK and across Europe, we call on the British government and its European partners to make all efforts to move forward swiftly to negotiate a new settlement. This is what Caterpillar said. The UK is an intrinsic part of our European supply chain, and we urge our parties to reach an agreement that quickly removes the uncertainty, allows the UK to retain full access to and from a single market, and protects the interests of business with strong commitments and investments in the UK. That's Caterpillar's take on it this morning. And I wonder, Phil, you wrote about this, that this could go the easy way or the hard way as we're thinking about trade agreements.
Right.
Where do you think this leaves companies, for example, like Caterpillar, trying to get their products into not just the UK, obviously, but the EU?
Right. So first, I think Caterpillar has that exactly right. That is what ought to happen. And the sort of easy way, that would be the easy way. The easy way is where one says, unfortunately, it came to this. We all know, you know, what we've been doing with trade. Let's just codify that and move on. The hard way is if, for example, the European Union says, we're worried about other countries leaving. We're going to make an example of the UK. So we're not going to make life easy for them. They're not going to get all the preferences they've been enjoying so far. They will live to regret this. And you get, you know, sort of a vengeful response. That can happen. I mean, there is a real concern about the EU unraveling, and that's part of what has prompted this sort of broader concern. One of the challenges in this, you know, if you look at what Caterpillar is calling for, they're saying, you know, the UK government should sit down with Brussels and do this. We're going to have a change in the UK government, that you had the Prime Minister resign, or say that he would soon resign on the basis of this. So, again, more uncertainty because it's not even clear who will be doing that on the UK side, trying to strike this deal that keeps things calm.
That's a good point, Phil. Mike, do you think, I know you and I were talking this morning before the show, before we were on air, about chatter you were seeing last night, particularly in the ag community, about how this may be an opportunity to renegotiate contracts. What's your sense of that?
Well, you know, the U.S. Has been very successful at negotiating free trade agreements directly with a number of countries, and they've done very well in agriculture. We've got some excellent examples of that in South America with Colombia and with Peru, and we've also got our NAFTA agreement, and we're striking agreements with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're in the process of that. So, you know, they could deal with U.S. ag community might find it easier to deal with the U.K. independent than UK as part of the EU. The EU has been very, on agriculture, has been protectionist. They've made it very difficult for us to get our agricultural products into their marketplace. And in fact, we're running a substantial deficit in ag products across the Atlantic with the European Union. They ship us high-valued wine and cheeses and hams, and we don't make it up with what we ship them. So we might actually, in some ways, depending on our negotiating skills, we could come out of this in agriculture. We could come out of this possibly even a little better.
Phil, do we have any sense of how Washington will react to this? I mean, certainly before the vote, we heard pretty strong stances from President Obama, just saying, like many other world leaders, we think it's important for the British and for the UK to vote to stay within the EU. Do we have a sense of how Washington will react to this now?
I have not yet heard an official response from the administration. There have been some voices. House Speaker Ryan, I saw, came out with a statement, which is that the UK is a close ally and we will work together to do what we can. Of course, we're undergoing our own transition. And so by the time these things will be playing out, it's probably under a new administration for us. And so we bring our own uncertainty to the table with this. By the way, the one, I think Mike's exactly right on the agriculture point. The one thing I would add to that, though, is yes, we would probably have an easier time dealing with the UK, certainly on agricultural issues, but we also lose a voice inside European discussions, which often argued in our favor, that as sort of a counterbalance to the more protectionist voices in the EU, the UK was one of those countries in there pushing, and not a small country, so we'll lose that a bit with the rest of the European Union.
We did have a statement from the White House this morning saying, and the president did just say the people of the UK have spoken and we respect their decision, and saying that the special relationship between the UK and the US is enduring. And so just kind of, I think, just kind of an initial statement from that. Let me ask you, we just have two minutes or so left here. Phil, you've written about being worried as to whether or not, and by we, I mean the entire global economy, if we're in a bit of a financial bubble, and if a shock like this, I'm curious what you think the implications of that concern about whether we have some financial bubbles in the economy, what this will mean for not just the American economy, but obviously for Illinois.
Yeah, so I think normally what you would hope for is going into a shock like this, you are, you know, maybe running budget surpluses and you've got relatively high interest rates, and so you've got all these levers that you can then pull to fix things when stuff starts to go wrong. And we're actually at the other extreme. We're sort of running deficits. We've got, in many cases around the world, monetary policy pushed to where we even have negative interest rates. And I think that's one of the causes for concern, is that if you put a shock on top of that, we don't have the ability to respond the way we would like. And you can have people respond to this shock by saying, pulling back on purchases, having a recession, and that kind of thing can propagate around the world and hit us right here in Illinois as well.
Mike, what do you think? How do you think Illinois farmers are reacting this morning?
Well, I think, you know, the big key thing here is the uncertainty, and it's sort of like, what happens next? Is this part of some greater destabilization that's taking place with, you know, various groups of countries that have agreements with each other? And so I think we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out over the next, it's going to be at least a 2 to 3 year process, maybe longer, if Parliament approves this Brexit. And so it's kind of going to see whether, is this the first shot of a revolt that's taking place, or was this something that was an aberration and the EU is going to have to reform a little bit and try to tamper down any kind of a revolt that might be coming out of this. So we're just going to kind of wait and see.
That's Mike Dougherty. He's a senior economist with the Illinois Farm Bureau. Thanks also to Phil Levy, a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, giving us a sense of how Illinois may be affected in all of this. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with me.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Coming up, we'll be talking about some new rules for high school athletes in the heat. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Illinois High School Association has just announced a new heat safety policy that will begin in the 2016 to 2017 school year. It's designed to protect student athletes from heat-related illnesses and injuries. And joining us to talk more about this is Matt Troha. He's the Assistant Executive Director of the Illinois High School Association. Hey, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with, what dangers you think high school students and athletes are facing when they're playing sports in hot weather?
Well, you know, I think that just the overexertion and the, you know, just being kind of left out in the heat too long, you know, there's a lot of chances for dehydration and you know, at the other end of the spectrum, heat stroke. And, you know, we just wanted to have a policy in place that's sort of all-encompassing and uniform for our postseason events when we really kind of take over running them.
So the postseason events, what steps are you going to be taking to help student athletes stay safe?
Yeah, well, our new policy, what it uses is called wet bulb globe temperature. And what that kind of takes into account is not just your heat and your humidity, but it also looks at, you know, how much of a breeze there might be, what the cloud cover might be providing. Because, you know, I think we could all say that if it's 97 degrees out, it's going to be hot. But it might be 97 with a constant 20-mile-an-hour breeze, and it may not feel too bad outside. So this wet globe temperature, wet bulb globe temperature, is really the most accurate predictor of what the conditions really are and what dangers they may present. And really it's been some, our sports medicine advisory committee, it's a group of doctors and athletic trainers from all over the state, and it's really been in the works for several years, and partly the reason that we're able to move forward it now is just some of the technological things that are available to our schools and the ability to sort of access it more.
Well, is that how you'll readily be able to, or I was wondering how they'll be able to know what that temperature is. Is that something that you all will disseminate? Will coaches and players be able to know these conditions?
That's a great question. And they will do that at each individual site. So for our postseason, it's generally going to be a regional, a sectional, or a super sectional, or a state tournament. And there is a device called a wet bulb globe thermometer that can give you that reading immediately. And one of the technological advances I was about to kind of talking about or referencing there is that now you can get a lot of the information you need from pretty much any standard smartphone weather app. And once you get that, there's a conversion chart as well as a part of this policy that you just look at the heat, humidity, and a few other factors, and then you'll be able to get that wet bulb globe reading and then determine, you know, if the policy comes into play or not. So those are kind of some of the things that have now made it more easily to do, because we're in a difficult situation with our membership and the state of funding right now for schools. It's difficult for us to say to schools that, you know, that we're going to make you buy this $500 thermometer or whatever it might cost in that range. So some of these technological advances have really kind of helped this cause along.
That makes sense. I wonder, have you experienced any resistance from coaches who are concerned that the new policy could, for example, alter playing schedules? I imagine for sports like baseball, where rest for pitchers is important, a policy like this might be result in games being postponed.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you mention that. For our Class 3A, 4A, which is our large class, baseball and softball finals were held the second weekend in June. And if folks recall, that was when we got really hot weather. We were in Joliet, so the south suburbs, for baseball, and we were in Peoria for softball. And both places were kind of mid-90s on Friday and high 90s on Saturday. And so we were able to use our policy and put it in place that day. And some of the coaches initially did have some pushback because they felt like maybe it disturbed the flow of the game a little bit to have some water breaks added in there and things like that. But I think as it progressed, you know, they understood that it was for the safety of the kids. It made sense. It affected both teams equally. And really on the other side of it, there's another piece that while there could be some pushback a little bit, I think, on the other side, there's a part that really, I think, helps the coaches in that because this policy wasn't in place before, the schools and the coaches were kind of on their own a little bit, and there might be a little concern. Let's say that you and I were rival coaches getting ready to play in a baseball regional championship on a Friday night, and my star pitcher needed one more day of rest before he could come back, and you show up at my place, it's 95 degrees, and I say, you know what, it's a little too hot. Why don't we just cancel it and wait till tomorrow? And in your head, you're thinking, well, are you just doing that so your pitcher can pitch
right
tomorrow?
So now there's actual rules in place, so everything's
exactly.
Really quickly, Matt, we just have a few seconds left, but is there any chance of this policy being extended to all high school sport games instead of just postseason?
I think that there always is, and a lot of times when we start policies like this, a lot of times it ends up that we work with the state legislator and it becomes a law, and that's how it goes about. But a lot of our schools have been very proactive in the regular season and are doing a lot of things to protect their kids. So I think it'll be a discussion that will continue over the next coming school year.
That's Matt Troha. He's the Assistant Executive Director for the Illinois High School Association. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, thank you for having us on.
After the mass shooting in Orlando, Illinois artist Greg Zanis created 49 wooden crosses, one for each of the victims. They now stand as a memorial in Orlando. Zanis has made more than 15,000 crosses. They're all made to honor victims of violence from Newtown to Chicago and now Orlando. And he joins us from his home in suburban Sugar Grove to talk about this. Hi, Greg.
Well, hi, Nyla. Thanks for letting me come on your show.
I appreciate it. Can you tell us about your experience with Orlando? First, I wanted to ask, where were you when you first heard the news about the shooting?
Well, I was in church, and my pastor, Matt Mull, he was talking about the shooting and four or five times, and I was thinking to myself that he was talking about the American Idol girl. But when I got home, I picked up the phone. It was ringing, and it was a father from Chicago wanting me to put up a cross for his son in Orlando. And, you know, and then he told me what it was all about. And I said, well, that's not reasonable for me to go to Orlando. But he says, well, you put up crosses in Chicago every day. I know that. And I said, okay, well, then I'm going to go.
And how many crosses did you make?
I made 49 crosses with, of course, with beautiful red hearts on them, large red hearts on them. And I got them painted two coats of, you know, exterior enamel, so they look beautiful. And before I left, I put all the names and their ages on all of these crosses. In the, it was quite a truckload trying to get that many into my truck. Everybody said I couldn't do it, but it actually worked out. And if you know anything about lumber, it was so heavy my headlights never touched the ground all the way down there.
Wow. And when you got there, what did you do? How did you install them?
I had been called and given three choices of locations, including downtown at the Civic Center. And because this one actually is where there were 53 wounded people actually in that hospital, you know, I chose this location, of course. And when I got there, I was expecting one of the fathers to come, so I waited about 45 minutes, and I finally called him, and he said he didn't want to come with all the media around there. So I started unloading them around 11 or so, and pretty much it took me till 5 at night to get them out and stretched. I don't know if you can imagine 200-foot-long row of crosses that, you know, you pretty much look at them and they're just clean out of sight. That's how many are there. And it's, like I say, it was a most beautiful memorial. I don't know if you've seen them on TV or not, but there's a lake, beautiful, that's the name of it, right behind it. And like I said, it was a monumental task.
What prompted you to do this? Why did you start building crosses for people who have been killed by gun violence?
Well, 20 years ago on January the 15th, my wife's father was murdered just four blocks from where I live here. And I went over there and found his body in a pool of blood. And I started building crosses for homicides here in Aurora, Illinois. We were having 26 murders a year at that time. And eventually it got in the newspaper that, and I said I'd build a cross for anybody any time and deliver it anywhere. And that's where it's gotten to this point, where people call me whenever something happens.
I'm so sorry about your father-in-law.
Well, it's tough to talk about it.
I can't imagine how tough it must be. Do you feel like the crosses have helped you with your personal grieving process for your family members?
When I put a cross up, sure, it's for the victim, but it's also for myself and for my family and for my personal grieving. It's tough to understand, but I know that the victims relate to me because they know that I'm not a counselor, but I am a carpenter. And, you know, I feel like God's using my hands to do his work that nobody else would actually want to do.
How many crosses have you made? So in the past 20 years, how many crosses have you made and where have you put them?
Well, I've made over 15,000, and 90 or 99% of them go unnoticed. Even in my Chicago crosses, very much go unnoticed. And then there's, of course, the ones that do get recognition. In the beginning, there was a murder in Naperville. This lady smothered her kids, Marilyn Lemack. Just a month later, the Columbine High School massacre happened, and people had already said you'd deliver crosses anywhere, anytime. So people were contacting me from Littleton, Colorado. So went and made 15 crosses representing two for the gunmen, because myself, I felt they had mothers and fathers that were grieving too. So that caused a huge controversy, but I still stand and say that I feel I did it the right thing, because having lost my friend, you know, nobody wants to go unnoticed. And
yeah, did you, for Orlando, did you make a cross for the shooter as well?
I don't do that anymore, Nyla, because I already know what that's going to, you know, it's going to upset a lot of people.
You've been a victim of violence, and it's something that's personally affected you. Do you feel like there's a message that people need to understand about not just the people who have been victims of violence, but also a message about people who perpetrated it?
Well, if you kind of look at it, you know, the way I look at it, a lot of these young men, and I don't mean to say only young men murder people, they're rejected. There's love missing. And as a Christian, we're supposed to go out and love our neighbors, love our friends. And then, I met the governor down there.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because I know you went back to Orlando, right, after installing the crosses, and you did meet Florida Governor Scott. What happened there?
I mean, the same with him, you know. So I finally, and I hope he doesn't misunderstand him, I got a hug out of him. But then I also asked him if, instead of, you know, doing what I consider a callous cold interview, let's not interview at all. I'd like to just go over and lay hands on the cross and pray with you. And then at the end of, you know, I said, well, I'd like to end it with a hug. And then his staff called me and said that you broke, meaning me, I broke his heart there doing that hugging. He couldn't actually talk. He was so upset. I could see that.
Yeah. I must have been a very emotional moment for you also.
You know, I do, you don't misunderstand me, get the opportunity to meet very famous people. But I also like to bring them down to the simple level as, you know, we're all human beings, and even the governor needs a little love.
Was it a tough thing for you to do something of the magnitude of what you did in Orlando?
Well, Nyla, the first day, you know, it was just a job. You know, I mean, you know, mostly. But then the next day, I could tell who the family members were. And having been on TV, they were all coming up to me. I had 9 separate family members meet me in a 4-hour period. And the last hour, I just started crying. I couldn't stop. You know, I was just taking in too much, and I just felt that I couldn't just stay there anymore. So I got out of there, and then again I went back to Florida Turnpike and just tried to sleep, and I couldn't sleep, and I'm just crying.
I know you build crosses. Have you also built memorial markers for people of other faiths?
Always. In Newtown, I put up 25 crosses and 1 Star of David, for example. And then in Tucson, Arizona, at the Gifford shooting, I put up 5 crosses and 1 Star of David. And then in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I went to the Shiite Temple, and I put grapevine wreaths up for that situation. Whenever I'm called, it's, you know, I'm going to do the honoring thing. And in Milwaukee, these people were in a house of God that, you know, of course, that bridges everything.
You were talking about Chicago, and you were saying that a lot of, you get noticed for the crosses that you've put up in Columbine or Aurora or in Newtown. Where are most of your crosses? Are they in Chicago, and do people notice them?
No, they're nationwide. And in Chicago, they go very much unnoticed, and they don't stay up very long.
How do you pay for all of this?
You know, I mean, I pay for it out of my own, whatever I can. I'm on a fixed income. I'm Social Security. And I'm at around a $700 loss for this last trip.
Greg, so I guess my last question is, what message do you want to send with doing this, with these crosses that honor people who have died across the country?
Well, I always say the same thing. Greg Sanos loves you. There's somebody out there that loves you, and And love conquers a lot. Not conquers all, but it conquers a lot.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Greg Zanis is an Illinois carpenter and artist from Sugar Grove. Thanks for being with us, Greg.
Okay, thank you, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Up next, we're talking about Game of Thrones season finale.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you are not familiar with that music, that is the theme song from Game of Thrones. The season six season finale will air on HBO this Sunday evening. Joining us now are co-hosts of the Nerdette podcast, Greta Johnson and Trisha Bobita. They're going to do what they do best. They're going to nerd out with us about Game of Thrones. They're joining us from WBEZ in Chicago now, where they produce the podcast. Ladies, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us. Anytime anyone wants to talk about Game of Thrones, we will be there.
Absolutely.
And you guys have been doing such a great job. For people who maybe have not been listening, you've been doing a recap every week with Peter Sagal, where you guys talk for an hour. I was just listening to the last recap that you were doing. So I think, do we need to do a big spoiler alert for maybe people who are not caught up yet? Should we spoiler alert this whole conversation? It's going to ruin anyone who hasn't gotten to this point where they're at right now.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea.
Okay, so that's our spoiler alert. Can you guys give me, Trisha, why don't you start? Can you give me a 3-sentence summary of Game of Thrones for people who have never watched the show?
It's Harry Potter with sex and violence. All men must die. Ice zombies and dragons are coming.
That's good. Greta, what do you think?
That is really good. So I actually just have one sentence. Think of, picture the current political campaign, but add boobs and dragons and incest.
Okay.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that if people have not watched Game of Thrones before, you have got them intrigued. And I have to say, full disclosure for the audience, I stopped watching at the Red Wedding because that just was my point of, I can't watch this show anymore. And then I started brushing up. So what is that? Was that like 3 years ago, you guys?
Yeah, I think that was season three, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I started paying attention a little bit last fall because I had to interview George R. R. Martin, and then I have not really paid attention, but I've been prepped by people who watch Game of Thrones. I will say that. How are you guys feeling about this season so far? I've heard that it's less grim than previous seasons.
I think this season is becoming better and better television. People were worried that now that they've gone beyond where George R. R. Martin's books are in many of the plot lines, that it would be a little bit of a Wild West. Who knows what's going to happen to these characters now? But I think it's allowing them to make more episodic television that works for the medium. So characters who often in the books are off in parallel universes almost because they're so far away from each other are finally starting to intersect, and we're getting to see conversations between characters we love instead of characters only interacting with other minor characters. So I love Tyrion and Daenerys together. I love that we have some Stark children getting to get back together and fight for their home. I think it's more interesting to see our favorite characters square off or work together than to see them all in their own little pocket universes.
Greta, what do you think?
So I probably would have stopped watching Game of Thrones at the end of season four, actually. So I made it a little farther than you, Nyla, and I did read the books. But I just thought it was getting really boring. And then Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, came up to me and Trisha and was like, hey, you guys host this podcast called Nerdette. You're nerds. Let's recap Game of Thrones. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll keep watching this show. So I'm kind of the hater among the three of us.
She's the reluctant hero.
Yeah, I'm the reticent viewer, if you will. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of things about this season that I've liked a lot more than the previous seasons. You know, like Tricia mentioned, I think the pacing is a lot better now that it's not based on the source material as much. You know, the showrunners are kind of having to figure out things as they go because, as Tricia mentioned, it's not based on the book.
Right, because
we've
gotten past the point of HBO has caught up faster than George R.R. Martin can conclude the series. Speaking of reluctant heroes, do you think this is a more satisfying hero season for the good guys? I'm referring to the Starks.
Well, the Starks are, I think, the central, with Tyrion Lannister, I think this whole series is really a story of the Stark children growing up. So most of the main characters are either Stark children or their trusted advisors or their friends. And I think seeing them get to start to come back together is really rewarding. The brutal thing that happens to their father at the end of season one sets us all on this emotional journey of wondering how they're each going to survive and deal with what's happening to them. And I think that with Jon Snow in particular, seeing the evolution of what he's got to do now that he is not necessarily immortal, but has come back from the dead. Again, spoiler alert. Sorry for anyone.
Right. Well, if you're not caught up, we gave them the spoiler alert at the beginning. Yeah.
But I think, you know, really dramatic things have happened to each of the Stark children. So Jon Snow actually resurrected. Sansa Stark has had sort of a rebirth and come into her own and has become so much more powerful than we've ever seen her before. And Arya Stark is now a trained assassin, and who knows where she's headed next. So I'm excited about all three of those characters and seeing where they go through the rest of the series.
Yeah, I think Bran has a lot of potential,
and
too.
Bran.
Like, who knows if he can time travel? Maybe?
That was the one episode I did watch this season,
right.
when the people were attacking him, and they were all in the cave, and it was bad.
I think also you could say it's been a good season for the Starks just because, again, spoilers, we got to see Ramsay Bolton die last week, which everybody
felt
was
good.
It was time. You know, that guy was just such a villain, the way he treated Sansa Stark, especially in season five, that to finally see him die and by horrible means was, you know, it was
ultimately
a very
satisfying thing. Right.
Yeah.
Greta, I wonder how you feel about, as we've mentioned, this is the first season without the source material. As someone who's read the books, do you actually like it better now that we've gone beyond the Reddit? I don't know if that's heresy to say that, but I'm just curious your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind being the Game of Thrones heretic. I do think it's better. I think for a number of reasons. You know, I think often in the previous seasons, and you can even kind of see this with Peter in our recaps, it's easy to get kind of smug when you know what happens, right? I mean, like, even in season three with the Red Wedding, it was like, oh, guess what, everybody? Like, buckle your seatbelts. This crazy thing is going to happen. And now that the book readers don't know, I think it's sort of a power shift. But I think it's really exciting. I think it's also what opens up the door for so many more theories that you're seeing online after each episode, because the playing ground is level, right? Like, no one actually knows what's going to happen. And that means that we can all kind of try and piece together what's happening now to see who can end up on top.
So when I hear the Game of Thrones theme song, I start thinking about the map and all the different worlds. And this season, it seems like the worlds have gotten smaller. At least there are storylines that are converging. And Tricia, what's your favorite storyline that's kind of emerged this season?
I like seeing Sansa and Jon together and the two Stark children back together and seeing what it's going to take to form political alliances there. And then on the other side of the Narrow Sea, I like seeing Tyrion and Daenerys together, them both stumbling, learning from each other, and finding a way to actually do some political maneuvering. The show, in its early seasons, there was a lot of King's Landing as a central place where you were squabbling about who was going to get to be the king or the hand of the king and
all
this.
The politics.
And as someone who loves political dramas, I liked that part of it. It's like West Wing with dragons, right? Like, it gives you, kind of scratches both itches that you might have as a TV watcher who likes the fantasy side, but also likes the intrigue and the power plays. And now that we're starting to get back to that, where people are having to create alliances and people are, you know, double crossing each other, I find that a lot of fun.
Greta, what's your favorite storyline?
I think I will second Tricia with Sansa and Jon. I find that really satisifying. I actually think partly
because it's been years they've been separated.
Right, years and years. Yes, since they headed south and Ned Stark was beheaded, really. I mean, like, they left Winterfell.
Back when I was watching, yes.
Exactly, yeah. So it's been a really long time. And I think, too, both of those characters have developed so beautifully over the past couple of seasons that, you know, like, I think there are some other characters like Daenerys and even Arya where I have a hard time seeing their actual growth over the past couple of seasons, but with Jon and Sansa, I have no doubt that, you know, I've seen what these characters have been through and seen how much they've grown up and how much they've changed and become stronger. And so to see them together is just really satisfying.
I'm talking with That's Greta Johnson and Tricia Bobita. They're co-hosts of the Nerdette podcast that you can find online. They do a recap of Game of Thrones. It's like an extra special Nerdette that they do when Game of Thrones is on. Let's talk about Sunday, because seasons have traditionally ended for Game of Thrones with huge cliffhangers. Again, we're ruining this. If you didn't know that Jon Snow died, he's dead, and then he came back, right? And obviously, so he's not dead now. Are you expecting any cliffhangers or resolutions as on Sunday? What are you guys thinking might happen?
I'm guessing that we're either going to see King's Landing burn, or the match is going to be lit and we're going to wonder if it's going to be stopped. So they've been hinting all season that the only way for Cersei and the Lannisters to really break free of the more and more powerful religious movement that's there in King's Landing, the Sparrows, everything they've tried hasn't worked. They thought that they were going to be able to use the old playbook that they used to keep power and to gain power. And this new faith militant religious order has taken away all of those comforts. And now I think the only thing left to do is burn that wildfire under King's Landing. And
Trisha,
so I don't know if we're going to see it in the finale or if it's going to be teed up as something that'll happen at the beginning of next season. But I think we're going to see some smoke and some fire, and King's Landing may not be long for this world.
The entire control room is agreeing with you. We're getting nodding heads. So, Trisha,
good.
Everybody
yeah.
likes that theory. Greta, what about you? Are you expecting resolutions, cliffhangers? What are you thinking?
Well, first, I would like to ask that the control room make Disco Inferno, the song that comes out of this segment. Can we make that happen?
Yeah, that's going to happen. Now that you've said that,
good.
That will happen.
Thank you.
See?
I appreciate that. I think what I would like to do is just give everybody a hot tip when they watch this finale on Sunday. And remember, as you mentioned, you know, last time around we thought Jon Snow was dead. The other person who we thought maybe was dead at the end of last season was the Hound. And I think it's a really good time to remember that unless you see someone dead, they might not actually be dead.
And so if they're dead, they could come back to life.
And if they're dead, they could come back to life. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of wonder at this stage how high the stakes really are going to be with a finale like this, especially given last week's episode, which was super intense.
Do you think it's too late to start watching now?
Oh, no.
The nice thing about these HBO seasons is they're pretty short, right? So each season is 10 episodes. So it's really 60 hours of TV after next week, which when you consider that against a network television show that might have more like 22 episodes per season, it really wouldn't take that long to catch up if you decided to watch even one or two a week over the course of the summer through the fall. You would end up ready to go for the next season.
Also, it's really nice to binge. I actually prefer binging on Game of Thrones than I do watching it in weekly increments.
Mm-hmm. How many more seasons are there?
One.
It's to be determined officially.
I heard two.
I think they haven't. Yeah, they haven't officially decided. There were rumors a few weeks ago that they were going to do one of those slightly longer split final seasons.
Or they might do like one, the half season, where it's technically one, but then they give you a 6-month lag, so really it's two.
And now we've seen that the cast has gone in sort of a group to the creators of the show and said, we want raises for season 8, which implies there may be a season 8. So we'll see.
Man, Trisha's so good at the internet.
What?
Spend a lot of time.
Okay, last question.
The internet about Game of Thrones.
Last question for both of you. What's your favorite thing about watching Game of Thrones? Why do you like it so much? Greta?
Oh, man, you're going to make me answer first?
Yeah.
I wanted to think about it. Well, Trisha, what is my favorite thing about watching Game of Thrones?
Is it the
dragons? I think it's being a part of this community, the conversation afterwards. Honestly, I don't think it's even Game of Thrones itself. I think it's, you know, like Game of Thrones has reached the level of like the Super Bowl in terms of the thing that everyone is watching. And it's so exciting to be a part of that conversation and to think about like, oh, maybe Sansa is pregnant. Like, who knows? I think that's really, it's just a really dynamic, fun thing to be a part of it.
I like that it's one of the few things left that I watch week to week. So
yeah.
I binged on Orange is the New Black last weekend, for example. And instead, like Greta said, of sort of gobbling it all up at once and then trying to figure out who's maybe on the same episode as you or anything like that, you can have a conversation in person and online all week long with a show like Game of Thrones. And especially now that we're past the books, I love all the theories. I love the crazy Reddit theories and the, you know, people who, like, you know, use CGI Photoshop crazy magic to try to figure out what's, you know, written on pieces of paper in the show. I just love nerds. So I think it's really fun to see people's enthusiasm, and I find it contagious. So the community is what drew me to the show. I didn't start watching from season one. I started watching later because I just liked that people were getting excited and sort of letting their excitement through in a way that not everybody is, you know, doing. Sometimes people are too cool for school, but Game of Thrones fans typically aren't.
I feel like your enthusiasm has now bowled me over, and I feel like I may watch on Sunday evening.
Oh, you totally should, Nyla.
Greta Johnson and Trisha Bovita are co-hosts of the Nerdette podcast. You can find them on iTunes. Where else, ladies?
Nerdettepodcast.com.
There we go.
On iTunes, Google, or on iTunes, search Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones, and that's how you can find that feed.
All right. Thank you. They're joining us from WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you, ladies.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks.
And that's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on our NPR One app for us. You can search for The 21st. As just like Nerdette, we're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us if you want to give us feedback, if you want to leave us a voicemail, that's all on our website at www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. As we say, have a good weekend. We did want to play Disco Inferno for you. So here you go.